This is a Doxcast, not an Argon Soxcast, or a Bagels and Loxcast. Now I'm hungry. This is a Doxcast. It's a nerdy Toxcast. Discuss a Moxcast with Rich Early and friends.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another expansive episode of the Doxcast. I am your co-host, Josh Trumbo, and once again, I'm alone in the studio, but I am joined via Skype by the very knowledgeable and designerific. Those are terrible adjectives. You think I would have come up with something better ahead of time, but I choked under pressure. Anyway, Eric Royce is joining us again. Hello, Eric.
Hello. Thank you for having me on again.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us. For those of you who might not be aware, Eric is a board game designer, designing, of course, the great and wonderful Spirit Island. He joined us about a month and a half ago, I think it was, somewhere around there, on the podcast, and we filled up our time and still had so much more to talk about that he very bravely agreed to join us again, and so here we are. So what's been happening since you were last on the podcast? Anything exciting going on?
Well, let's see. I mean, development on the Kickstarter continue, or expansion content continues, and also we've started sort of narrowing down, like, okay, what is the Kickstarter going to look like, which is exciting. You know, talking to Greater Than Games about how things are going to be structured. And you know, we did a little bit of that when I went out to do some intensive playtesting with them out in May. But now that there's less than a month to the Kickstarter, it's feeling a lot more real.
Yeah, that tends to happen. So once again, folks, for those of you who are tuning in live or if you're listening to this later when we post it, Spirit Island is a cooperative board game for 1 to 4 players, soon to be a few more, I understand.
Yes, the expansion will let you play up to 6.
Which, that sounds like a really good brain-burning time. but it's a fantastic game. Takes the notion that a lot of board games take, where you are settlers moving to a new land and trying to take control of areas and such, and turns it on its head. So instead of being the settlers coming to take over the island, you are instead ancient spirits who live on the island and in balance with the native peoples there and such, and you are trying to remove the invaders, the colonists, by whatever means necessary, be it floods or fire or just plain scaring them away. Mm-hmm. So we're going to kind of pick up where we left off. The last podcast is available on ParadoxCNC.com and iTunes. If you search for DoxCast, you'll find it there. We talked a little bit and got to know Eric a little better and about how he developed a passion for tabletop gaming and turned that into an opportunity to actually design games and get into that field. And we delved a bit into Spirit Island, the base board game, or the base game. It's not a baseboard game. That sounds boring. Has someone made that yet? I know there's like the deck building game, but
I don't think I've heard of any other construction themed games like that.
Well, maybe I have to file that one away for later. So we talked a bit about Spirit Island more. There. Now we're going to move into the expansion, Branch and Claw, and of course that'll lead us into the new expansion that's coming through on this Kickstarter, and we'll see if we can get a few juicy tidbits out of Eric before the day is up. But let's go ahead and get into that. So, Branch and Claw, where do we want to start with that in terms of talking about the design and where the elements came from and all those things?
Well, probably the first thing to talk about is sort of how it arose. Branch and Claw is an expansion which was put out at the same time as the base game of Spirit Island. And it consisted of a number of things which were all designed alongside of the base game. And actually, in fact, originally were part of the base game. When I first pitched the game to Greater Than Games, everything from Branch and Claw was right in there, and the only difference was that the, you know, in sort of a teaching game, a learning game, you omitted some of those Branch and Claw elements. the event deck or some of the other things. Mm. And because you were playing with pre-suggested power progressions, you avoided all of the cards which interacted with the various token types, which come in Branch and Claw. So you didn't end up needing to deal with that rule's complexity either.
Okay. Yeah, that was going to be one of the first things I asked was at what point those were developed, because it seemed like some of them were in place. You know, when you first get the base game, you notice that the realistic side of the map tiles has the icons already printed on there. So, sorry, so go ahead and continue.
Oh, no. So, everything from Branch and Claw was developed right along with everything else. One of my very, very, very early hand-scrolled prototypes actually had... I was still in sort of explosion stage of design where you try out a bunch of stuff and see what works. It had like 7 or 8 different types of tokens.
Oh, wow.
From there, some of them worked great and some of them didn't work at all. And others, maybe they looked like they might work. And so I sort of, messed around with them for a little while. And then some of those did and some didn't. So everything there was done purely alongside of the base game. And for those who are only familiar with the base game, I'll say tokens are some things which you can place on the board which represent sort of enduring influences. There are beasts which are dangerous to the invaders. There's disease which might keep their population from growing. Wilds which represent dangerous lands which are hard to explore. And strife which represents invaders who are in enough internal dissent and turmoil that they do not expand effectively. They don't end up hurting the land because they're too busy fighting amongst themselves. It can also represent madness, madness is thematically represented by strife. So these concepts and others were developed from very early on. Actually, strife was a late addition, but the others all were from sort of day zero, as were some of the other things in Branch and Claw. The event deck, which I'll circle back to as something which is highly polarizing, that was also there in some form or another from the beginning. In the very beginning days, the event deck was not a separate deck. Instead, the invader cards each had an event which was positive for the spirits and an event which was positive for the invaders. Hmm. But the problem there is that because they were on the invader cards, those events were fixed based on what terrains came up,
right,
which led to both sort of an annoying sameness to everything, where it's like, oh, this, whenever they explore into sands in stage one, they always have this event which happens, as well as a gaminess, because then you go like, oh, well, the only two stage one cards left are sands and jungle, which means it's either going to be event X or event Y. And for those reasons, it didn't end up feeling so great, so I ended up separating out into its own deck, which also allowed just for a lot more variance. You know, previously you'd see all but one of the events in each stage every game, which again, very repetitive. So separating them out, gave it a lot more variety. So these were all sort of part of the game, and in large part you just didn't use them in your first play. Then Greater Than Games, I can't remember exactly when, maybe 2014 or so, came to me and said, Eric, we know that you have like sort of the teaching game and the not teaching game, and we think that you should take most of the stuff which isn't in the teaching game and we should pull it out and make it an expansion, released at the same time as the base set. And I was pretty resistant to this idea at first because everything was very intertwined and entangled. But then I thought about it for a while and I realized, first of all, okay, yeah, all right, I can sort of see some of the rationale there. And second of all, I know a lot of people, oftentimes myself included, who don't listen when a rule book says, for your first game, play with this simplified rule set.
Right.
And I really didn't want people starting off with all the stuff from Branch and Claw, because until you know the dynamics of the base game, until you have some basic familiarity with the system, a lot of those details, they offer variety, but you haven't really explored the variety yet. So more variety is sort of wasted on you, and they also do add complexity. And that was finally what really not merely made me willing to split it out, but enthusiastic about splitting it out, was going, yeah, actually, it's not just one or two games that people need with everything else before they start really appreciating these. It's probably more like, 5 or 6 or 8. And that's a good number for an expansion. So I started to pull them apart, and that was difficult. The hardest part was the Minor Powers deck. It's a sort of, you know, workhorse deck. Virtually every spirit draws from it in every game, and it had been about, like, 60-some-odd cards large. But as you can imagine, like one of each one of the powers has some of eight different elements, and one of those elements, for the sake of example, is animal. Mm-hmm. Anything which deals with beasts tokens, like I think all of those powers have animal on them, and many of the powers that deal with disease have animal, because animal also deals with, you know, biology and blood. You know, it's humans. Right. Humans count as animals under this paradigm. You know, they're animals. They're not plant or fire or air. And so if I'd simply done a naive separation and taken like, oh, okay, well, what's all this stuff which uses tokens or rules, you know, the slightly more advanced rules, then the base game Minor Powers would have had, I don't know, like three cards with the animal element on them and something like 23 with fire or sun. It would skew the elemental proportions way out of whack, which in turn then affects how well each spirit plays. Like, you know, if you're playing Thunderspeaker and you're really looking for those animal elements, or right. if you are playing Lightning and it's like, oh, fire is really great for me, mm-hmm. then the game difficulty is going to be skewed, positive or negative, in a way which, unless you sit down and like look through the deck and count, is going to be kind of invisible to you. You'll just know, like, I never seem to get very good power draws when I'm playing Thunderspeaker, or, you know, I have no problems getting great powers for Lightning, mm-hmm. which kind of skews the whole balance of the game. So the metaphor I gave to my friends was that it was like the deck had so many interdependencies, and I talked a little last time about the difficulties in making a deck, you know, that I had to kind of tease them apart and like pull them apart like this giant blob of M&M's stuck together by marshmallows.
That sounds delicious, by the way.
It does, but when it's your hands that's so sticky and hot, there's pain. But then later there's deliciousness, which is what happened after the fact. Because once everything did get separated, and it didn't just involve separating, it involved like dropping power cards, creating new ones in order to fix elemental balances, make sure that both expansion and base game had a good proportion of, like, you know, defend powers, Tahan powers, all that other stuff. Once I was done, and I started just playing, like, okay, here's just the base game, it felt really, I'm not sure what the word is, not streamlined per se, but focused? Yeah, so, but it felt really good. So, you know, even though I had been concerned that there wouldn't be enough variety. So, after that happened, it was really great, and, yeah, so let's see. That's about where that wound up. Any questions, or shall I continue rambling about Branch and Claw?
Well, we can kind of continue in that vein, because one thing I'm curious about is where the decision was made to keep scenarios in. Because I think one of the great things about the base game is how modular it is as a base mm-hmm. game, and then you can add in the expansion, which makes it even better. But oftentimes when you're taking out complexity or taking out modules, tokens, things like that, you know, like you said, the tokens were taken away completely. The event deck was taken away completely so that that could be mm-hmm. saved for the expansion. But in the base game, we do have scenarios. We do have adversaries. And those mm-hmm. things could feel like an expansion material. But we get some here and we get some in Branch and Claw. Where was the decision made to keep those in? How did that come about?
It was a combination of two factors. Well, for adversaries, there wasn't much question. Adversaries were and are the primary means of boosting the difficulty of the game. And any co-op needs some way of boosting difficulty. Right. Because otherwise, if it's once you find your good level of challenge, you know, if it's calibrated well for players who are just picking up the game, then it will quickly become too easy and you'll lose all your attention. So adversaries were always, actually, that's not true. In the very early days, adversaries were not the way that you boosted difficulty. There were a set of, I can't even remember what I called them, but like the game is harder and the game is easier cards, each of which had a difficulty modifier. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of how you used them was sort of like, well, pick a couple. It was sort of loosey-goosey. And the difficulty modifiers were very loose because some things would stack with each other, whereas others wouldn't, or in fact conflict with each other. you know, if you have one difficulty boost, which is, you know, instead of when the invaders would build a city, instead they build five towns, and then a second difficulty boost, which is cities do plus 10 damage. Those don't actually stack with each other.
Right.
So the eventually I decided that it would be both more thematic and more sort of, I don't know, resonant with the genre. It would be nice if you could sort of feel like, okay, we're playing against a particular nation. And since this is sort of an alt history, it would be an alt history nation based off of one of our own, something from our own history, possibly entirely recognizable, but not from an identical version because we're in a slightly different universe. So they ended up getting bundled together, which allowed both for more thematic integration, which I like, and the ability for the different difficulty boosts to kind of play into each other in interesting ways. Which if you look at England, you know, it's base level sort of then, and its additional loss condition define, you know, sort of then spread out and everything afterwards kind of, you know, pushes on that hard. So scenarios could have been left to an expansion, but A, I had a lot of ideas for them, and so we weren't really hurting for them. And B, they're unlike, like, adversaries are optional in that you don't start playing with them, but then once you want to boost the difficulty, they're kind of your go-to. Mm-hmm. Scenarios, even then, like, some people, I know people who've played the game 20 or 30 times, 40 times, and have never touched scenarios. It just doesn't call to them. Mm-hmm. Whereas other people play them every chance they get. So they were already sort of optional enough that it was really easy for people who didn't want to deal with them to just leave them in the box, and players who were intrigued by them to grab them as soon as they found them interesting. So it was sort of, you know, low cost in terms of mental overhead. There's also the sort of the side consideration that I sort of think of the scenarios as being one of two major types. One of them would be, I don't know, mods or variants like Blitz, which is primarily about playing the game in a fundamentally different mechanical way. And others would be more sort of, I'd call them story scenarios, like Dahan Insurrection or War of the Shores from the expansion, where you have sort of a different goal to what you're doing for a narrative reason. And the two aren't entirely mutually exclusive. They overlap somewhat. But the Blitz scenario in particular, I wanted to make sure to include in the core game because about, I don't know, one tester out of 10, maybe, loved the game and really didn't like the fast, slow power split. They right. found it frustrating that they had to wait to resolve some of their powers. And so, you know, we looked at, like, okay, do we want to drop that distinction? But there were just way too many costs to doing so. And, you know, it could have been done, but it would have changed the game dramatically in a way which neither I nor Christopher liked. And so instead, as sort of like, okay, let's figure out a way, something which we can do for those people so that they can't, you know, they don't have to just throw up their hands and never play this thing which they mostly love. And so develop the Blitz as a way for them to do that. So I wanted to make sure that at the very least was in. And once you have scenarios at all, then, you know, oh, include Dahan Insurrection and Rituals of Terror, because mm-hmm. those change things up a lot and can be really interesting.
Right. Yeah, I think that's definitely one of the fundamental differences, like you said, that the invaders, you know, they change the difficulty, and they also change a bit of how you have to look at the board and the game.
Yep.
Whereas the scenarios are a chance to just fundamentally change the game rules and make it a different experience. So
yeah, where you're shooting, where your goal is just really entirely different. Or the means which you as the spirits are using to pursue it. The adversary rules, for the most part, pretty much modify. There could be an adversary in the future which modifies how spirits do things, but at the moment, I think the closest it comes is, like, you know, the island heals blight slowly. It doesn't really impact, you know, the spirits' play at all. Whereas something like the rituals of the destroying flame, it's like, well, in order to actually hurt the invaders, you need to perform this ritual and forget a power card, and blight happens, and all this other stuff. I had a great game sometime earlier this year, which was a combination of Rituals of the Destroying Flame and Rituals of Terror. So yeah, we had to, like, you know, keep getting the Dahan together over and over, and couldn't start off. And starting off, the invaders both couldn't be terrified and couldn't be hurt.
Oh wow!
It was great.
That sounds daunting.
Yeah, it was neat. I mean, you know, there's a lot of fun combinations that we don't playtest the scenarios with each other. Right. Specifically, they're not designed for that, and they can end up interacting in weird ways. But once you play the game a bit, you can start to get a good idea for, like, oh, this scenario is going to be, you know, go off the rails with this other one because, you know, this scenario makes towns super badass, and, you know, we're playing against France, which gives you all the towns in the world. So
right, right. Okay.
So, yeah, no, scenarios, you know, lots of variety for relatively low cost in terms of, like, you know, paper in the box.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's excellent. And so, yeah, what else can we discuss with Branch and Claw? How about talking about, obviously, the two new spirits that come in the box that focus on a kind of a different aspect with the tokens and things? And
yep.
Is there anything you can tell us about the development of those, or I'm guessing, you know?
It's a while ago, so I don't remember. The thing that shines through most clearly is those two spirits are Keeper of the Forbidden Wilds, which is sort of a guardian of forbidden places, and Sharp Fangs Behind Leaves, which is a predator spirit, sort of the border of where the predator melts into the jungle. And you know, and its form is a sort of a great cat, and the Kickstarter almost didn't get to the point where those were included in the expansion. I had developed sort of one spirit which showcased, you know, it was like, here's a spirit which uses this token, one for beasts, right, one for wilds, one for disease, and one for strife. And it nearly was the case that none of them made it to the expansion, just because the Kickstarter, you know, it did well, but not, you know, over the moon well.
Right.
I think the initial goal was like 40,000, and it made it to, I think, 80 or something. But, you know, but that was a late surge. And so we were kind of sitting, kind of holding steady at 60. And Paul was like, I don't know. You know, it's like, no, I guess we're just not going to get to that. But then we got a nice surge, and so we managed to get to those two, which was great. Because I had some of my playtesters mock threaten me with bodily violence for the lack of Sharp Fangs Behind the Leaves. Because it was their favorite spirit, in some cases for play style, because they really like the sort of, I don't know, not guerrilla warfare, that's more Thunderspeaker, but the sort of hit and run, you know, hunting feel of Sharp Fangs. And some because they're just like, you know, great cat. Cats, yes, you know, and love that. So that's sort of my strongest memory from there. So I mentioned that there were, you know, four such spirits. We didn't end up getting the disease or the strife spirits then, but they are now back at Gen Con Greater Than Games preview, two of the spirits from the upcoming expansion, Jagged Earth. And they are... Burning Plague Brings Vengeance, and yes.
Grinning Twister stirs up trouble, I believe.
Indeed, yes. And those are both ancient spirits from long ago. Not entirely true, but they are both sort of... the groundwork for them was laid. Grinning Trickster is somewhat similar to how it was. Its core concept hasn't changed, whereas the disease spirit has changed drastically and has actually been split into two, only one of which was previewed at Gen Con. The other one is not disease-centric. The original disease concept sort of had too much going on mechanically, and so half of it turned into Vengeance is a Burning Plague. And, oh, sorry, as has been mentioned at Gen Con, you know, things may change about spirits, including
right.
their names, before the Kickstarter. So,
yes.
So half of it became Vengeance is a Burning Plague, and the other half of it became one of the other spirits in the expansion, which has not yet been revealed.
Ah, so we know we're getting at least three new spirits?
Mm-hmm. Yep, actually, that number has been mentioned online. Paul's mentioned
okay.
that there are eight.
There are eight? I have missed that piece of information. That's
yes.
I'm really excited now.
Yeah, I can now tell you that I have a binder which is sitting in my room somewhere, which has ideas for, I think, 27 spirits.
Oh, wow.
There's been a lot of work on this game over the last year. Now,
yeah.
When I say ideas, I mean that ideas. They're, you know, that includes spirits where I have a page of scrawled notes and literally nothing further. Many good ideas don't test out well, or many interesting ideas don't test out well.
Mm-hmm.
There are some which I'm, you know, somebody online said, well, you know, I've done game dev, and you know, it's my experience that you can always make a concept work out if you give it enough time. And the answer is, well, yes, but sometimes that means you're spending so much time on one concept that you could have developed 10 other in the same amount of time. You know, and looking at, you know, what we have lined up, some of these spirits have, in fact, taken probably 5 to 6 times as much attention and time as others. It really does vary in terms of how quickly they coalesce and click together. Although I find that spirits which build on previous concepts tend to come together faster because I have sort of a sense of the dynamics around them.
Right.
So,
well, I suppose one thing that's nice is that if you find a concept doesn't work, it still exists for lore purposes, because we have had spirits mentioned that are probably never going to end up in the game, or, you know, possibly will never end up in the game, but then it's just further building that world. So they're never really lost. It's
And also often, like, mechanical pieces from one concept will make a showcase in another. The number of potential spirit designs is extremely large, and like a couple of concepts ended up getting dropped because it's like, oh, well, if I did all three of these, like, you know, these three concepts and these two already published spirits, these are all so close together that there's really only room for, like, you know, 3 or maybe 4 spirits inside this bounding box. I can't really fit 5 there. There's going to be, like, it would work, but one of these spirits would kind of feel like one of the others. There's just no way to space them out enough. Okay, which of these, you know, is sort of, you know, which of these three is most promising? Which 2 of these 3 are most promising? Which am I going to drop? Which am I going to pursue? You're asking for a juicy tidbit, so something which has not been announced anywhere else. You mentioned spirits which have been mentioned elsewhere, you know, may or may not make an appearance. There is one spirit which is mentioned in some of the lore already, which will be making an appearance, which is Volcano Looming High.
Oh, excellent. That was
actually
one that I was just thinking about.
Okay.
Because I remember there's him and there's the Watcher. I can't remember the exact name, but that one would probably be fairly boring because he just doesn't do anything except watch.
Oh, yeah. Watcher acts not. No, Watcher acts not will not be appearing. Not without fundamentally changing its nature. Volcano Looming High is obviously a volcano spirit, which is sort of, you know, earth and fire aspected. Also, a touch of air for Looming High. It is a spirit of peaks. There's a lot of spirits down in the deep earth, but most of them are so earth-centric, so earthbound, they're not going to touch the surface of the island much. I mean, kind of look at Serpent for that dynamic. But Volcano Looming High is a spirit of the volcano as it reaches the surface, rather than, like, you know, the deep magma, which occasionally, you know, bubbles up but doesn't do a whole lot else, which interacts with the rest of the world. And so it has a little bit of the air, but mostly fire and earth. As you would expect, it can blow its top in fairly spectacular fashion, but not too often.
So one thing when coming up with the new spirits and designing them, obviously with the expansion, it's already been said that there's going to be a little bit of everything, more of everything. So we'll get some new powers and some of that. But how much do you need to look at the existing power cards to see the combinations of elements on there to make sure that the innate powers for a given spirit are well represented?
Oh, that's something, especially for the minor power deck, that is a large portion of making it, I'd say. The minor power deck has so many constraints that I could talk about them for half an hour. I may have actually done so last time. That's a lot of it. And there's also now another consideration, which I'm glad to get a chance to talk about, which is the balance between branch and claw mechanics and not. Branch and claw introduced all of these token types. And so now, once you include branch and claw in a deck of 60-some-odd minor powers, there are 4, which add beast tokens to the board. So if you're not playing, you know, if you're playing Sharp Fangs Behind the Leaves, you start with a power which adds beasts, and you can you sort of devolve your presence into beasts. But even if you're not playing Sharp Fangs, you can still have, if you change in the right ways, if you pick up the right powers, you can, you know, learn to create dangerous beasts out of the wild. Mm-hmm. But if you're sharp fangs, you especially want to pick these up because they're really good with your strategy. So if you add more minor powers in an expansion, the question is then, okay, what do you do about that? Because if you add some more minor powers, you're now diluting all of the mechanics from Branch and Claw if you include, if you don't include them. But if you do include them, then you're requiring that this new expansion use Branch and Claw. So, and I've, you know, I've been contacted by people who are concerned in both directions about, you know, that the this new expansion might require Branch and Claw or might not. So I sat on that for a while, but I finally figured out what to do, which is the new expansion does not require Branch and Claw to play. You do not need to own Branch and Claw in order to acquire and play the stuff in Jagged Earth. However, the way it accomplishes this, some of the game materials, you really just don't need anything else. You'll be able to, like, pick it out of the box, not read the rule book at all, and put it in your base game set and play it immediately. Those will be the minority. You know, those will be a few things. Like, you know, at least one spirit will do that. There'll be some things which you don't need Branch and Claw for, but you should read the Jagged Earth rule book in order to get the most out of. And those will probably be, you know, I don't know, like, at least, again, at least one spirit, probably more. And then there will be some spirits which do use the rules from Branch and Claw. They use one of the token types or some other rule from Branch and Claw. The rule book from Branch and Claw will be reprinted, basically. Either, I don't know if it's going to be physically separate or if it's just going to be in the back of the rule book for Jagged Earth. But the rule book will be there. And also the four token types from Branch and Claw will be, there will be punch board for those four token types. We needed to include enough tokens for 5 to 6 player games anyways. And feedback from the field has been that the existing tokens are a touch large. They kind of use up a little more land real estate than anything else in the game. Like, you know, the beast tokens have a bigger footprint than the cities do. So, you know, if we make them a little bit smaller, then we can use not that much more punch board and still include enough tokens for just 6 players right off. And that also means that somebody who doesn't own Branch and Claw yet can get Jagged Earth, read the Jagged Earth rulebook, use the, you know, decent amount of stuff in Jagged Earth, which doesn't require anything from Branch and Claw. And then whenever they feel like, okay, now I want to, you know, add some more things, then they can look at the Branch and Claw rules, include the Branch and Claw tokens, and add new minor powers. The minor powers in Jagged Earth are, you know, going to be marked with, you know, this requires Branch and Claw rules, not because every single one of them uses tokens, but because they're designed to be included as a set, and some of them do use tokens.
Okay. That seems like a pretty good balance and way to do it, because, yeah, you do introduce some very core concepts in Branch and Claw that, you know, we're talking about those spirits, the trickster and the plague, that focus around those tokens. And if you don't have the tokens, then you've got a couple spirits in the box that are just sitting there taunting you.
Yeah, yes, very much, which, you know, that's not really this particular trickster style. It's not so much about taunting and more about meddling and seeing what happens.
By the way, I just have to say, I know things, titles and names and cards and things can change, but I really hope that tricksters, the cards that have been previewed already, stay the same, because Surprise Tigers and Overenthusiastic Arson are two of the best titles for cards I've ever seen.
Thank you. Yes, Unexpected Tigers has been in since the beginning. Those two actually are carryovers from one of, I think, maybe the very first version. I'm not sure. They have survived due to popular acclaim. Even there are iterations where Unexpected Arson, which I'll mention to anybody who didn't see the stuff, it's a card with some risk. It destroys a town, but then you draw a minor power just as a randomizer, and if it has fire on it, then you do extra damage, but you also add blight. So it used to be underpowered, and so it wasn't really worth the risk. And even when it was underpowered, people were like, this card isn't good enough to play, but I really love the concept. You should make it better.
Oh, that's excellent. So we've got some folks in the chat who've been asking a few questions. I want to make sure I get some of those out to you.
Absolutely.
So let me see. First of all, do you know, and this may be beyond the scope of your knowledge here, but coming up with the Kickstarter, do you know about how long it will be from when the Kickstarter ends to when the projected date for when the expansion will start getting out to people?
The last I had heard was 18 months. The original, the core game Kickstarter went nearly a full year over, almost entirely because of artwork. And Greater Than Games is determined to not repeat that mistake and to underestimate, you know, that art might take a while. In fact, it's likely to take a while. Commissioning the amount of art you need for one of these things is a pretty big bottleneck, because you can't, you know, they couldn't start commissioning art as soon as I worked on it because they didn't know what they needed art of. That is, in fact, still not fully pinned down. The spirits at this point are pretty much known, but power cards are, you know, still potentially in flux, and the details of, like, spirits' unique powers, those can change. And, you know, last time, actually, a couple of those changed. Not last minute, but, you know, going on later. So they are, you know, being conservative and saying, you know, look, yes, we know this is a while, but, you know, that's, we want to make sure that this goes okay, as opposed to, you know, they sort of pride themselves on getting their Kickstarters right, and they were not happy about having the first one be that late.
Right, and I think it's better to set expectations long and come in early than the other way around.
Yep, that would be great, but, you know, it's, yes. You know, I'm hoping we'll end up beating the clock, but, you know, I don't want anybody to be counting on it, because if they, you know, can't get their hands on it for 17 months, they're going to spontaneously combust or something.
Right. So another question that's come up, someone asked specifically about when will the details about the new spirits come through? Will that be right when the Kickstarter comes, or are they going to tease out information? And I'm going to expand that to be, you know, other things, like when will we find out about new adversaries and some of the other things that are coming with that?
I don't know for sure. My guess and expectation is that some stuff will be, you know, some information will be put out right away, but that they'll, you know, save some in reserve, you know, sort of like, you know, so that people find interesting things to come look at, you know, over the course of the campaign. Mm-hmm. But that's really their call, not mine. So I'm not 100% positive.
Okay. And I do believe we were speaking earlier, you're going to be talking to a few more outlets besides just us as you get ready for the Kickstarter, and potentially some more information will be revealed along those avenues as well. So if people are following you and along the media trail, we might get some more snippets with that as well. So
I might do some sort of, if I can manage to get time, I might do some sort of, you know, online chat or post something. I'm doing an interview with the Cardboard Herald later this week, and I think that's all on my that's on my calendar for now. So, let's see. All right. Any other questions?
I'm going to throw in one.
Sure.
Before we do another one from here, because this is something I'm curious about, and I think a lot of people are. If they haven't thought about it yet, they're going to want to know. So Spirit Island, a four-player game, can be a big, beautiful, brain-burning time. And I know that the playmat exists, so that you and the Champions of the Dahan pack, so there is a five- and six-player version of it. But this expansion is going to expand upon that idea. Is there anything that's different about a five- or six-player game that potentially speeds it up or changes that so that, you know, it's not adding additional, you know, time per player as much? Or is it pretty much just a way for more people to play together?
It is. There's two answers to that. Answer number one is there are no intrinsic mechanical differences to five- or six-player. There is a dynamics change which kicks in around 5 to 6 player, which is that the board starts being too big for a single person to really pay attention to the whole thing. Hmm. You end up, you start to see this, you start glimpsing the corners of this at 4 player, where if you're kind of off on one side, the other side, like, you may look at it, but it's really not your primary concern until it's sort of mid to late game when you get over there. Mm-hmm. Or if you happen to start in the center and you're trying to figure out which way to branch out. Once you get to 5 or 6 boards, players, and this isn't like I've told people go do this, it's just what I've observed, players tend to not tunnel vision, but they focus on their own local problems a lot more. You'll still get like buffs flying back and forth, does anybody need to be fast if somebody's playing lightning, that kind of thing.
Right.
But once it gets beyond a certain threshold, people will actually just stop trying to keep track of the whole board because it's like, no, this is too big. So I'm going to, you know, I'm going to care about this. And you really get this kind of, I don't know, it's almost like, you know, trust building, team building exercise where it's like, okay, the three of you are like, I'm cooperating with player A on this board and player B on this board, and they're cooperating with players C and D on these other boards, but I'm just going to trust that they have it and trust that they'll tell me if they need my help in some crazy ass plan. Because otherwise this is as much as I can think about and this is what I'm going to do. So, you know, even with experienced players who've played hundreds of games, that tends to happen in 5 and 6 players. Mm-hmm. So that is what I call not a rules-based complexity lower, but sort of an intrinsic thing which just seems to happen. Now, I'll caveat this with, I still think that 5 to 6 players with newer players is a terrible idea.
Yeah.
5 to 6 player support was not included in the base game, partly because of component costs, but also partly because, you know, like I said, you know, people don't always listen to the instructions when they say don't do this as a first game. People wouldn't listen for 5 to 6 player games either. And it's like, okay, I really like the teaching experience. I have seen the teaching experience with this for 5 or 6 players, and it's not a good one.
Yeah.
5 to 6 players plays fine when everybody knows what they're doing, but not with new players. Mm-hmm. So that's answer number one. Answer number two is yes. One of the things the expansion is going to include is a number of play options, ways to do things a little bit differently, which aren't necessarily, you know, you don't need to use them. They're optional. And one of those is playing an archipelago or archipelago. I'm not actually sure how to pronounce it. But I'm assuming I'm going to forge bravely ahead and say that it's archipelago, you know, where you can have multiple smaller islands. And what that does is, again, it sort of changes the locus of people's attention. So you can say, oh, all right, you know, we're playing this game and we'll have, you know, 6 players, but we're going to have 2-3 player round boards which are joined together by their oceans. So you can get from one board to the other, but it takes a little bit of setup. And unless you're on one of the 2 boards, which is sort of across the ocean strait from each other, you're not likely to do so right away. So for early through mid game, you're mostly going to be dealing with sort of the visual complexity of just 3 boards. You can split it up even further than that if you want. You know, you can have, all right, we're going to have an islet of 2 boards and an islet of 2 boards and an islet of 1 board. And go with it that way. So that's one way where you can change the rules up a little and use that to help limit the sort of scope of what a given player is looking at. There are no rules changes which will limit the fact that, you know, the spirit phase is going to go at the speed of the slowest player. Mm-hmm. For that, you just have to resort to the, you know, if you have one person who APs terribly, you say, you know, hey, you got 2 minutes. Finish your turn.
Does the game come with a timer for those people? Is that
it does not, but it includes rules. The base game includes rules authority, and you know, there's a sidebar called the urgency of war right in the base game, and it says like any player has the authority to end the spirit phase at any time. You are totally allowed to. Some players I know will use a time limit far more. Say, hey, I'm gonna go grab a drink. When I come back, let's start. Mm-hmm. And use sort of soft deadlines like that. And I know some players who don't like that, but I know not a lot of others who are like, oh, I feel totally fine doing this since the rule book says I can.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Excellent. All right, so we've got another question here I'll ask, and then before we're finished on time, I do want to talk to you a little bit about another game design that you've got coming that's apart from Spirit Island. Let's talk about this real quick. So just recently posted on BoardGameGeek, it looks like yesterday, I actually saw this. Someone put their super deluxe version of it where they built the island up and, you know, used a lot of terrain and things. So you've seen that.
Holy crap, yes.
So they were just wondering what your opinion was of it. And then another viewer jumped on top of that question and just asked if there will be any sort of deluxe components or anything that may be coming for Spirit Island, whether they be part of, you know, like stretch goals or anything like that. Is that something that might be a possibility?
Anything like that set? No, that's like, that's the equivalent of that, like insane Catan 25th anniversary. I don't even remember what anniversary, but that, you know, like, you know, the thing which comes in like a giant chest, which requires 2 people to move.
Right.
That's the kind of thing where, you know, if Spirit Island is still going strong 10 years from now, okay, maybe we'll think about it then. As for other components, I do not know for sure. I know that some people have asked about it and the publisher has looked into it. I do not know what they found in terms of like what the feasibility was or how much it would cost to do or whether it would work out. So that's not a detail I know. As for what my opinion of that was, I think wow would be the first expression. Somebody online said like, you know, wow, scanning the board is going to be really hard. And honestly, though, I felt like the terrains were gloriously clear for scanning the board. The painted invader pieces would throw me because I'm used to scanning for white when I'm looking for threats. So, you know, if had I been painting them, I probably would have done them a brighter white just because that's what I'm used to. Or given the explorer's white flags or something. But that's for my own convenience, not for aesthetics. It's just, wow, it looks absolutely fantastic. And then took the minis for the spirits, like that's, you know, like the playmat, which has the pictures of them in their home terrains. It's like, whoa, that's fantastic. So, absolutely beautiful. Jaw dropping.
Yeah, no, that was very cool. And also as part of that, and I'm sure the answer will be the same as in regards to deluxe components, kind of thought on an insert, because I know my base game box is stuffed to capacity with just Branch and Claw in there. Now we got another one coming, so I'm going to have to start carrying around two boxes, I think, unless...
I don't think everything is going to fit in a single box. If it weren't... The limiting factor is just like, you know, with eight more spirit panels, like, they're 9x6, so you can't put them side by side. You can't turn them on end, and that creates a certain minimum thickness, which then some other things like the boards have to go on top of. Mm-hmm. So just the geometry of it doesn't quite work in fitting in the core box, which is too bad, because I tend to like everything being in one box. Again, I don't know. I know that that Broken Token has gotten a lot of requests. If people want to see inserts, then, you know, continue pinging them. Ultimately, it's not my call on that one either.
Right.
I like keeping everything in one box. And aside from the spirit panels, I actually can fit all of my prototype stuff for the expansion in one box, even sleeved, which I don't usually sleeve my cards. But the spirit panels are going to push it over the edge.
Yeah. All right. Well, awesome. Thank you so much for all the information about Spirit Island there. Let's go ahead and take a few moments here before we need to sign off and tell us about...
Okay.
What it was, Science or Die, is that right? Did I remember that correctly?
Yes, Science or Die.
Yes.
It is a real-time spatial matching dexterity cooperative game. What was the tagline? Spatial dexterity strategy co-op? Real-time? Yeah. There's a lot of adjectives in a row if you choose to string them all together. You and your fellow teammates are part of a lab which is attempting to cure a number of bioengineered plagues which have broken out. In that way, the premise sounds similar to Pandemic, but it's a little more tongue-in-cheek than Pandemic, or irreverent might be the best term. It's set in a hypothetical future where, you know, people can print botulism off their 3D biological printers. And so the end goal of the game, the way you win, is basically to figure out what all of the diseases have in common on a very abstracted level, which is sort of, you're figuring out what libraries, you know, whatever jerk who's doing this is using, so you can just make a single cure to cure anything they might make and actually go, like, you know, get your lunch break. The cures you're making are designed using cards, which you lay down on a table, which show pictures of blocks which are connected to each other with various lines. And the diseases then have, you know, a name and sort of requirements on them. Like, you know, maybe it might be the cure for this disease must show at least three cylinder blocks, or there must be more triangle blocks in the cure for this disease than square blocks, or other things like that, which sort of constrain what design cards you can lay down and how they can connect to each other. So you have this sort of like, you know, okay, hand management, you know, cooperating, because each person only gets one card at a time. So you're trying to figure out where you can play these cards to design the cures. Then once you've designed a cure, you actually must build the cure. And when I say build, I don't mean as an abstract game mechanism. I mean you must physically take wooden blocks and in real time stack them to match this design which you have yourself has just figured out on the table. Every pair of lines in your design shows you two blocks which must touch each other. Any blocks which are not joined by a line cannot touch each other, and only a few of the blocks will be able to touch the table. So you're building this tower and trying to get it together. Once you complete it, you have cured that disease, which earns you both sort of research points and insight, which you can use to get tiles, which represent your knowledge about the sort of fundamental underlying nature behind all of these diseases, which you're then trying to puzzle together. You can break it apart and reassemble it real time. This is all real time, turnless.
Yeah.
To try and like, okay, all right, to try and finally figure out enough about it that you can just make a master cure and win. Each of you, everybody is doing, you know, anybody can do any of these things. Anybody is able to participate in either the disease design, the cure design, or the cure building, or the master cure tile puzzle. But each player will have a single role, which will give them a special power, which will may make them more suited towards one sort of thing or the other. In addition, as you learn more and more about the disease, as your master cure becomes more and more complete, many of these special powers will get more powerful over the course of the game. So you get this kind of escalating, all right, well, when we started off, I could, my power was that I'm particularly good at, building. I think it's like drunken biologist, inebriated, intoxicated immunologist or something, where you start off and when you build one of these towers, one extra block can touch the table. But maybe now you've managed to build up a master hypothesis for the master cure enough that you have enclosed, four yellow icons. So now you can build and five extra blocks can touch the table, which then makes it a lot easier, which so you get this kind of accelerating cycle.
Awesome. So a lot of times in board games, they use real time to indicate that there is a time limit. Is that the case here?
Oh, so yes, absolutely. Yes, you have 15 minutes to try and assemble a sufficiently robust hypothesis, one which a master cure, which you have earned a certain number of master cure icons, basically. You're trying to create sort of completed areas with icons in them by tessellating various shaped things together. You earn the bigger shapes with lots of icons through curing diseases, and you earn the smaller shapes, which help you sort of round out your theories by end caps by doing smaller side builds. I'm alighting over some details here, but
right.
It's loads of fun. You get the primo experience playing with an app, but you don't need an app. You can play with just a simple timer. It should be awesome. Coming, I think it's kickstarting over the winter. Gray Fox Games is going to be putting it out. It's really neat. Some great hectic fun. It's glorious having two people at the table kind of, building stuff up carefully as other people are, checking their work and, don't jostle the table,
Oh, that sounds great. Definitely keep an eye on that. Let's go ahead and, as we close it out here, I know last time we talked about you do have a mailing list that people can get on so they can get information about Spirit Island and, of course, Science or Die and anything else that comes out of your fevered brain. So go ahead and tell us that and any other place that you'd like people to be able to find you on social media and such. So go ahead.
Easiest place to find me is on Board Game Geek. I'm username Darker, and you'll also see me pop up on the Spirit Island forums a fair amount. You can geek mail me there or drop me an email at erreuss@gmail.com to get on the mailing list. Once you're on it, you can unsubscribe yourself. I'm using mailing list software, which lets you set a username, password, then manage all your preferences or say, stop sending me crap. But it's very low bandwidth, at this point, just a few times a year. I lurk mostly on Reddit, but I'll be there occasionally. And that's mostly it. I am on Twitter as Mindways, but I don't post a lot. But I'm here every now and again, and I keep an eye out for, I'll do Spirit Island searches every once in a while to see if anybody has any questions, see if I can help them out.
Excellent. A couple other things to note. There is a living fact for Spirit Island for those who may not be aware of it. So search that up, and that is invaluable. There are always times a question comes up, and I know especially with I got the most recent printing of Branch and Claw, which unfortunately did have a number of errors in it. And so there is going to be an errata pack that will be coming along with the Kickstarter, or
It's coming over on a boat with the sixth printing of the core game, which I believe should be getting in the U.S. around October. So it will arrive around then, but it's kind of a coincidence of timing.
Okay. So I believe last I heard there wasn't word on whether or not that would be made available free, or if not free, it's going to be very low cost to help cover shipping and stuff. So for those people who have just recently picked up Branch and Claw, don't worry, there's going to be replacement cards and things to help you out there, because there are a few of them that made us scratch our heads a little bit until we looked in the FAQ, and then it's like, oh, okay, that makes more sense.
Yes, so we are very embarrassed.
Yeah, it happens. And then talking about the Kickstarter itself, I know last time the projected date was October 15th. I don't know if that's set in stone yet or if that's close to that.
I think it's the 16th. Okay. As with everything in Spirit Island, art is probably the limiting factor. I know they'd like to have some good art to put up there before the Kickstarter goes live. Mm-hmm. And due to various reasons, my August and September kind of blew up, and so I was a little behind in getting them some information, which they needed to start the art process rolling. So if it does end up delaying by a week, mea culpa, but I don't expect it to delay longer than maybe a week or two. And as far as I know, we're still on for the 16th.
Excellent. So we'll keep our eyes peeled for that, and of course any other little bits of information that come out along the way. So a little bit of housekeeping for us here at Paradox. We are recording live at Paradox Comics and Cards in Fargo, North Dakota. We do these podcasts. It is the DoxCast, available on iTunes, but we record them usually about once a month. We'll get together and record a block of podcasts and then release them every Monday. As I said, they go on iTunes and also on the ParadoxCNC.com website. So we hope that you'll tune in to more of these podcasts. Thank you so much, those of you who joined us in the chat and had some great questions and observations. It's always great to have that. But you can also find Paradox on Facebook. They're at ParadoxCNC on Twitter, ParadoxCNC on Instagram. And, of course, if you are in the Midwest or want to make a special trip, we'd always love to see you down at the store. So with all of that being said, Eric, thank you again so much for taking the time to drop by and give us all this great insight and all these juicy little tidbits of information. I'm quite literally salivating over here just waiting, and I'm going to have to wait another 18 months or so to actually get it in my greasy little mitts. But I'm very excited, and thank you again. And I apologize again for kind of gushing a bit, but Spirit Island is definitely, it's one of those games that has hit home with me so hard in terms of the mechanics and just the thematic elements and how it all meshes together. And I've had so much fun playing it and introducing it to new people, and I'm just looking forward to everything else that comes out for it. So thank you again.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right. Well, thank you again, folks. We're going to sign off here, and if you're watching live, we are going to do another podcast celebrating the 25th anniversary of the store. We're going to be talking a lot about that, so we hope that you'll stick around. We'll stop the stream and restart it, but either way, we appreciate it. We will see you next time on the DoxCast.
This was a DoxCast. Hope you think it rocks, cast. Oh, look at the clocks, cast. Until next time, be gone.